Support for today's addendum comes from PicMonkey.com. Once upon a time, photos only existed on paper, and if you wanted to edit them, you had to be a Russian spy or something. But now that we live in the digital photoverse, you can make everything look better with PicMonkey, an online photo editor. I know, I've used it lots of time, it's fantastic. You can design graphics, create collages, and take photos from meh to marvelous in just a click. So get a free trial of PicMonkey's premium subscription at picmonkey.com/undisclosed. Today's episode is also sponsored by The Great Courses. Now, I think I know my undisclosed audience. You guys are not people who are just here for entertainment. You are here to learn. And like so many of you, I love learning for my personal enrichment. I'm that person who likes to read dozens of articles a day and listen to lectures and watch them online. And that's the motivation behind The Great Courses. It is an amazing and incredibly engaging audio and video lecture series that is taught by experts in their fields. The Great Courses has been around for 25 years now. They've got courses in over 500 subjects, from history to psychology to cooking, and yes, even law. I recently reviewed their Fundamentals of Photography course, and it was done beautifully. It was fascinating. It was taught by a National Geographic photographer. I learned so much by somebody who's at the top of their field. And right now, The Great Courses has created a special. It's a limited time offer for undisclosed listeners. You can order from 8 of their best-selling courses, including the one that I reviewed, The Fundamentals of Photography, at up to 80% off the original price. But it's a limited time offer, so to get it, you go to thegreatcourses.com/undisclosed. Again, that's thegreatcourses.com/undisclosed. Hi, and welcome to the 8th addendum of Undisclosed, the State versus Adnan Syed. My name is Rabia Chaudhry, and I'm an attorney and national security fellow at the New America Foundation. And I'm joined with my colleague, Susan Simpson, who's an associate at the Volkov Law Group in D.C., and she blogs at The View from LL2. And of course, we have with us Colin Miller, who is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the blog editor of the Evidence Prof blog. Now, last week, we were all about the pings, cell tower pings, that is. Without them, even the state argued that Jay's stories alone didn't stand a chance. But we now know that using cell tower pings to determine the location of a cell phone is impossible, even if you try to recreate a call immediately afterwards. In fact, a listener sent us information that there are mobile apps, like one called NSI or Network Signal Info, that can demonstrate this in real time and show you what towers you're connecting to. So give it a shot. We'd love to hear back from our listeners to see what happens when you're making these phone calls from your cell phone and have one of the apps to track what towers are being pinged. So other than the cell tower information, cell records can also tell us, obviously, what calls are being made and received and when, and ideally to and from whom. And this information, if had been complete, would also have been a way to try and reconstruct what happened on January 13, 1999. Who had the phone, when, who they were contacting. And in this case, three calls were particularly instrumental to the state's case. The come and get me call at 2:36 p.m., and the Lincoln Park calls around 7 p.m. Jay told us that the come and get me call was from Best Buy, and the Lincoln Park calls were from Jen. But we have no proof of that, because as mentioned last week, these were all incoming calls, and no incoming call information existed in any of the records used at trial or given to the defense. But why?
It's not because those records were unavailable. They were. Here's what Michael Cherry said when I asked him about whether he'd ever seen a case in which the incoming calls were not produced at trial.
Just curious if you ever heard of a case where the police and the prosecutors did not acquire records of the incoming call numbers.
They didn't? Is that true?
Yeah, they did not. This is all we have.
I didn't know you had a choice. Well, how did they normally when we get these records, they show the incoming and the outgoing and the tower.
I also spoke to Ben Levitan, who has over 20 years of experience in the wireless industry. I showed him the phone records that the prosecutors had used at trial. He said he had seen it before, where only the outgoing calls were produced and the incoming call numbers were not given over, but that it only occurred in private investigations and personal requests for records. He said, in a criminal matter, AT&T is court-ordered to provide all information. But, he said, if someone requests their own phone records, it is the policy of AT&T to provide only the outgoing numbers under the premise of privacy. AT&T, based on the user request, will provide the phone numbers of outgoing calls because they have the permission of the user. However, AT&T feels that the privacy of callers, that is, the incoming calls, is violated if they release those numbers because those people didn't consent to having their information released. Ben Levitan also noted that the prosecution's phone records were titled subscriber activity. He stated that this usually implies that some of the records are not provided. AT&T true call detail records are called mobility usage with location. I asked him why, then, the police in this case had received records which only listed outgoing calls. He couldn't be certain, but he said that back in 99, the rules were a bit fuzzier. He said it's a more formal process now, but he thought it was possible that the Baltimore Police Department had just called AT&T and requested the records without an order, and in 1999, AT&T would have sent them. Or, in emergency circumstances, even today, police can quickly get phone records if needed. For instance, the police can call the carrier and say, there's a killer on the loose and they need the records now. In any event, Ben Levitan told me, there is no question that the prosecution could have easily obtained those numbers had they chosen to. He said, AT&T's database of records would have the incoming and outgoing phone numbers. It's certain that the information is there. So there's the answer. Those records did exist. They were easily obtainable. They were usually provided, no question asked. And it's very odd that a police-requested phone record would not have included the incoming phone numbers, and that those kind of records usually indicate a request by a subscriber for their own information and their own records, not a request by law enforcement. So why wouldn't the prosecution have obtained the incoming call numbers here? The way I see it, there's only three possibilities for why, as an attorney, you would not have gotten those numbers. The first is that you're completely useless. You're either too lazy or too incompetent to realize that those numbers have a big impact on the case. Because if you're paying attention, any attorney's going to realize that if those incoming calls show a phone call from a Best Buy payphone at 2:36 p.m. on January 13th, then it's game over. Done and done. Case closed. You can move on. But Kevin Urich and Kathleen Murphy weren't lazy and they weren't incompetent. I feel pretty safe in saying that we can rule this option out. The second reason would be that you know your star witness is lying, and you don't want those lies to be revealed by obtaining the phone records which would show it.
Can I vote for this option?
Well, it would fit what we have. So regardless of how the detectives had originally gotten the phone records, and regardless of why those phone records didn't produce the incoming call information like they should have, had it been a normal law enforcement request, the prosecutors could have gotten those records on their own. They had to deliberately choose not to get the records if they didn't want them and if they didn't get them.
And it actually seems like they did, right? Because it looks like we found some documents from later in that year, in the fall, I think October, November, that seems like it's a response to a request from the prosecutors, right, Susan?
Yeah, we know they got a certified copy of the cell records on October 12th, 1999, so one day before the originally scheduled trial date. So they did request the phone records, and in order to make sure that those records they got didn't have the incoming call info, based on everything I've seen, everyone I've talked to, they would have had to specially request that that information be left out. That brings us to the third option. You request the information regarding the incoming phone calls because you are a diligent attorney who makes obvious investigatory moves. But if that happened, we know that those phone records did not support the state's case, because if they had, we'd have seen them. That would have been a big deal. There'd be no serial. There'd be no undisclosed. None of this ever would have happened. So that means if they did request it, they didn't hand them over. And whatever they show, does not match up with a case that was consistent in any way with Jay's story. Either the prosecutors knew that Jay's story was a lie and therefore chose not to get incoming call info to make sure that lie was not exposed, or perhaps they did obtain the call records and did not produce them because they did show that Jay's story was a lie. Either way, I don't see a way around these records without concluding that the prosecutors knew that Jay's story was a bunch of made-up perjury.
But here's the thing. In his interview with The Intercept, Urich actually says that they did check the incoming call numbers. I'm going to read from the interview. Here's what it says. This is from Urich. For the period during the day before that call, and by that call he's referring to the come and get me call, we only checked to be sure that for every call that we could identify the caller or recipient and could contact him or her, and that that person verified that in fact it was Jay who had Adnan's phone and was the one using it. Okay, so Urich is specifically saying that they checked that they could identify the caller to Adnan's phone, meaning the people making incoming phone calls.
Yeah, it's tough to read it any other way. It certainly seems like Urich is directly saying they were able to identify the people who called Adnan's cell phone on January 13th. I mean, Susan, is there any other way to read that?
It's possible that by making sure they could identify who the callers were, they meant making sure Jay could give them an answer they could use at trial. I mean, if they asked Jay and he said, oh, it was this person, and they said, oh, that's good enough for me, I guess that could be construed as making sure they could identify every caller.
Yeah, what's interesting too, though, is if we look at it, Urich's statement seems inconsistent with what the state actually produced, assuming that what they produced is consistent with what they did, because Urich also says that they identified the recipients of calls, contacted him or her, and then verified that Jay is the one who had Adnan's phone. But if we look, for instance, at the 3:48 call on January 13th, that's a call that's made to Phil. Phil, again, is the person who, along with Jay, tries to interrupt the interview between Stephanie and the private investigator. And we have no record whatsoever of Phil ever being contacted by the police. And so certainly not all the people on the call log were interviewed. And there might be a good reason for that. That takes us to our first Twitter question. It comes from Claire Pearson. Her Twitter handle is @ClaireMTPearson. And she asks, have you tried to reach out to Anne, Patrice, et cetera, to see what they remember saying to the cops? And so let's lay some groundwork here. If we look to Adnan's call log on January 13th, at 3:21 p.m., there is a call from the cell phone to Jen. According to Jay at trial, this is a call he makes to Jen trying to track down his friend Patrick to buy some weed from him. Interestingly enough, Jen says that Jay would never call to ask for the location of Patrick. And so we've pointed out some inconsistencies between Jay and Jen. This is maybe the only time when explicitly Jen says, no, Jay is making something up. This didn't happen. Seems, moreover, that both Jen and Jay say that Jay is still at Jen's house at 3:21. So it's confusing to think of why exactly he'd be calling her house at 3:21 if, according to both of them, he's still there. Then if we fast forward to 3:59 p.m., there is a call from Adnan's cell phone to, according to the Serial website, to Patrick. Again, Patrick, the person whom Jay is trying to buy weed from. Now, it's interesting because actually this isn't technically a call to Patrick. The call is made to a house that is resided in by Patrick's sister, Patrice, and the line that's called belongs to Patrice as well. And so, according to Jay, when he testifies at trial, he called this number, he got the answering machine, eventually Patrice's voice came on. It's unclear to me whether he's saying it was her voice on the answering machine or whether she actually picked up the phone, but nonetheless, it's her line, and she comes on the phone or her answering machine picks up. Now, when Jay is first interviewed on January 28th, he doesn't mention this call to Patrice/Patrick. Nonetheless, the police have the call log and they decide we're going to track down Patrice and talk to her. And we discussed this before. We have the cover sheet. We know Patrice was interviewed, and yet the notes from that interview are never produced. And so on March 11th, the police go and they talk to Patrice. And what was said? That takes us to Adnan's current investigation, he has a private investigator that's working on the case, and he was able to track down Patrice and talk to her.
Just for the record, though, because this is a private investigator that is for Adnan's defense, and although we're privy to some of the stuff, you know, we're not always going to be sharing every single thing that the private investigator is doing or uncovering or learning, obviously, because it is for the defense. You know, this is not the podcast private investigator, but, you know, sometimes we will make an exception and share information like we are doing right now.
Yeah, and so the private investigator talked to Patrice, and it's interesting because the question that the police apparently asked back in 1999 was not what you'd expect. They asked why Adnan called Jay while Jay was at her house, not why the call was made from the cell phone to her house. Moreover, she had no memory of talking to Jay on the phone. She had no memory of him leaving a voicemail on the answering machine. Instead, the conversation shifted and it became a long conversation about the last time that Jay was at her house. And it was an occasion on which Jay apparently made a call from their house to some external number. Now, unfortunately, the PI talked to Patrice and we had a lot of follow-up questions. For instance, Jay didn't have a car. How did he get to the house? Could this have been January 13th? Why were the police so interested in this occasion on which Jay was at their house? But Patrice, at this point at least, is not answering the PI's calls anymore. So we're not sure if this is a dead end or if it's going to be ongoing. But you break it down, it certainly seems like Jay's trying to get in contact with Patrick on January 13th. And we have this interview with Patrice. There's a lot of possibilities in terms of what this interview could contain. And it seems like we're close to maybe finding a Brady violation. There might very well be something exculpatory in the statement by Patrice. But at this point, you know, it's a little bit unclear. We're not sure exactly what they discussed or how it might conflict with what Jay told the cops or testified to at trial.
Or in the case of Patrice, it seems that after they'd spoken to her, they had a radical shift in their theory of the case, and Patrice's statements no longer fit the new theory. During Jay's and Jin's initial interviews, the cops were convinced that Adnan had the cell phone all day on the 13th.
My theory at this point is, knowing how early on they were focused on Adnan and they were building a case around their suspect, that it didn't kind of matter to them who had the cell phone at some point. They just had to make the story work. So after they spoke to Patrice, I guess all of a sudden their theory fell to bits and they had to rearrange everything now that they knew that Jay is the one who had the cell phone.
It finally dawned on them that the story they were trying to piece together didn't make sense unless they listened to what Jay was actually saying, which was that, no, he'd had the car and the cell phone that day. Because when the police first got the phone records back on February 17th, they reasonably concluded that all those calls and all those cell towers represented Adnan's movements and Adnan's calls and things Adnan was doing. This, for example, is why Jay is put at Jin's house for the afternoon of the 13th. Because the detectives think that Adnan has the cell phone and is repeatedly calling Jay at the Pusateri residence. Hence why there are three calls to the Pusateri house between 12 and 4 o'clock. And why they keep asking Jay and Jin about the calls coming in on the landline, when, of course, by trial, they figured out there were no calls coming into the landline. This is also why, for example, Jay comes up with a story that Adnan called him and told him to meet him on Edmondson Avenue for the trunk pop, like he says in his initial interview. Because two of the calls that happen around the time of those calls to the Pusateri residence are routed through tower L652. L652 is located on Poplar Grove, near the corner of Edmondson Avenue. The detectives, when they got these records, and in the 2 weeks they spent looking them over prior to talking to Jay, had developed a theory of the case that involved Adnan making calls from somewhere near Poplar Grove and Edmondson to the Pusateri house. And when they learn of Jay, whenever that was, they obviously conclude that Adnan was calling Jay while he was at the corner of Poplar Grove and Edmondson Avenue. And Jay, always obedient, spins out a story about how that scenario occurred when he got a call from Adnan, drove out to meet him at a strip on Edmondson Avenue, and there was a trunk pop on Poplar Grove, right beneath L652.
So, Susan, do you think that they make this first effort, they talk to Patrice to try to confirm what's there in the call log, and it sort of goes disastrously? Do you think that's the point at which the state decides we're not going to pursue the incoming calls because while they could help our case, it's a Pandora's box, they could very well completely destroy the case?
I think when they changed their entire theory of the case about what was happening that day and where the phone was, they realized that further information could only make their case worse.
I mean, now that they had to reconstruct a story in which Jay is getting a come and get me call, right? And their entire theory, you know, they charged Adnan with first degree premeditated murder, that he now left the cell phone with Jay on purpose to commit this crime, even though they initially didn't realize he even had the cell phone. And so, you know, if they had incoming phone calls, then they'd actually have to show where Adnan called from for that come and get me call.
Here's where Patrice comes in. Remember how Jen and Jay both swear up and down that the come and get me call was made around 3:40 through 50? I mean, they don't agree on whether the call was made while Jay was still at Jen's house, but they do agree it didn't happen until around 3:40, 3:50 p.m. But if you look at the phone records, there are only two calls in that time frame. Well, first is to Phil at 3:48. The second is to Patrice's house at 3:59. Now, Phil was in Frederick. He was too far away for a place that Jay could have been hanging out for a pickup, which leaves Patrick. It looks like when the cops went to go talk to Patrice, they were expecting to confirm Jay had been at Patrice's house or Patrick's house that day, and Adnan made the come and get me call at 3:59 p.m. to Patrick's house to Jay, where he knew Jay would already be. And you can kind of see some reflections of this in the cop's statements and the prosecutor statements when they talk about how, oh, Jay changed the story to hide that he was involved in weed operations or to hide people who were selling him weed. Well, this could be one of the changes that they'd initially suspected, which is that Jay had changed the story from being at Patrick's house to being at Jen's house to protect Patrick, when in fact it was all just a big misinterpretation. So they talked to Patrice. Some point between that and the second Jay interview, they realized that no, Jay had the cell phone, Adnan did not have the cell phone. So that's when they have to do the radical shift in their story to explain why there were calls to Phil and Patrick when, according to Jay, there hadn't even yet been a come and get me call. So this is why, or part of the reason why, there's no time for the come and get me call that fits Jay's story. Because Jay's story, as it was initially written, was based on the theory that the come and get me call was really an outgoing call on the cell phone, not an incoming call, as it later became.
I mean, it seems that if the state didn't disclose it, this information, that it would have been a Brady violation. But apparently, Urich doesn't think so. And here's what he said in the Intercept interview. Again, I'm going to read from the interview. "We don't pick our witnesses. We have to put them on as they are. There were a lot of inconsistencies throughout Jay's prior statements. Almost all of them involve what we would call collateral facts. A material fact is something directly related to the question of guilt or innocence. A material fact would have been, I was with Adnan. And then you've got the cell phone corroborating that material fact. A collateral fact would be, we were at Joe's sub shop, but then you find out, actually, they were at the auto repair store. That's a collateral fact. It's not necessarily material to the question of guilt or innocence. So many of the material facts were corroborated through cell phone records, including being in Lincoln Park," end quote.
So to break that down, Urich says that the fact Jay was with Adnan is a material fact, but the location of where Jay and Adnan were when they were together, that's a collateral fact. So by Urich's definition, whether the come and get me call was made from Best Buy or made from somewhere else entirely, it's only collateral. And therefore, Urich would have had no obligation to produce it under Brady. Colin, is there any legal basis for this material collateral distinction?
There is a distinction between material and collateral, but what's important to note is that Brady covers both substantive evidence as well as impeachment evidence. And so substantive evidence would be, for instance, let's say that Jay or someone else confessed to the crime. Well, obviously that's substantive and that goes to guilt or innocence and that's material. But there's also a Supreme Court case interpreting Brady. It's called Giglio. And that says if you have impeachment evidence that impeaches a key witness for the prosecution, that's material as well. And keep in mind what we had and didn't have in this case. We have no one who saw Adnan getting into Hayes' car. We have no one in this case who saw the actual act of murder. The state's entire case is the combination of Jay and the cell phone records. And so Jay's story of when he first saw Hayes' body, the trunk pop, et cetera, when the come and get me call took place, that's at the heart of the state's case. And so, for instance, if Patrice told the cops something in her interview on March 11th that fundamentally contradicted Jay's story at trial, that would be material evidence under Giglio because Jay's a key witness for the prosecution. This impeaches him. Again, we're not 100% sure what Patrice said. We need to investigate it more. But, you know, you have two outcomes here, basically. Either one, the state accidentally lost the notes from Patrice's interview and she said nothing meaningful. The other option is she said something quite important that contradicted Jay. And in that case, if we can suss that out, that could very well be grounds for a Brady violation.
And the way I read York's interview, he almost seems to be admitting to that flat out. I don't see another way to interpret his claim that a material fact is that Jay and Adnan were together. But if Jay said they were at a sub shop and he and York later learned that they were at a different store entirely, oh, that's only collateral. I mean, he's admitting he did not consider evidence that Jay lied about where he was during the day when he was with Adnan to be something he felt obligated under Brady to produce.
Yeah, and we get a lot of questions. I wanted to add this point about why the DNA petition for testing hasn't been filed yet. This is basically one of the key reasons. It's sort of a symbiotic relationship. A Brady claim would make a DNA petition stronger and vice versa. And so this is one, it's not the only one. There's a few Brady claims being investigated, and it makes all the sense in the world to have these sorted out and included in the DNA petition. So for those wondering why hasn't it happened yet, well, there's the pending appeal. We'll see how that goes. But yeah, these claims are very real claims, and it makes all the sense in the world, again, to include these and to wait to file the DNA petition until these Brady claims are sorted out.
Yeah, and there's more reasons, too, why Yurik would have had incentive not to look too hard at the cell phone data or not to try and get further cell phone data. Because some of those incoming calls that you see on the call logs likely weren't real calls at all, as in they did not involve two people talking on the phone at the same time. For example, the 2:36 p.m. call was almost certainly not an actual call involving two people talking on either ends of the line. Because that call's 5 seconds long. And that includes connection time. The way AT&T bills is that as soon as an incoming call hits their infrastructure, the billing starts. So even before the first ring has gone off in the cell phone, AT&T is starting to bill. Which means the come and get me call is never a call at all. And it doesn't matter who it was from because no one talked that time.
Now, another call that is questionable in terms of whether or not it was a real call is a call that has been the subject of a lot of controversy and conversation and has, you know, now notoriously come to be known as the Nisha call. And it's certainly a call we get a lot of questions about.
Yeah, so this next question comes from Alice Morgan. Her Twitter handle is at AliceMorgan01. And she asks, was it established whether the day was wrong where Nisha spoke to Adnan and Jay on the phone? And so as a refresher, at 3:32 p.m. on January 13th, there was a call lasting 2 minutes and 22 seconds that was made from Adnan's cell phone to Nisha's number. The cell tower that was pinged by that call was L651C. If you believe the general range of cell towers, the phone is probably near Woodlawn High School and the Best Buy. Adnan, you'll recall, had met Nisha at a New Year's Eve party at the end of 1998, and they had started talking on the phone. Prosecution uses this call at 3:32 p.m. to try to prove that Adnan was with his phone at this time on January 13th, contradicting his story that he didn't have this cell phone between the end of school and the end of track practice. Let's start with Jay. So in Jay's first recorded interview on February 28th, he makes no mention whatsoever of the Nisha call. Then on March 15th, Jay gives his second recorded interview. This is after seeing the call log. At this point, he says, at about 3:40 p.m., I got the Best Buy call from Adnan. There was the trunk pop in the parking lot. They then took Hayes' car to the I-70 park and ride. They started driving north to the Forest Park golf course to score some weed. At that point, Jay called Patrick. So again, this 3:59 call where he was calling Patrick slash Patrice's number. And then at that point, after the call at 3:59 p.m., that's when Adnan makes a call that Jay describes as follows.
Did anybody else use the phone?
Yeah, Adnan, I can't remember whether he received a call or placed a call, but I remember he was talking to a girl. I can't remember her name. He put me on the phone with her for like 3 minutes. I said hello to her.
Where did she live?
Silver Spring.
You recall her name?
No, I don't.
Is there anything significant about this conversation that you remember?
No, nothing out of the ordinary.
Do you have any idea why Adnan would call this individual in Silver Spring after he had just strangled his girlfriend?
I don't, and I have no idea why he would call anyone. And the conversation didn't pertain to anything that he'd just done, so...
No?
No.
How long did that conversation last?
It was a pretty long conversation, maybe like 7-8 minutes, 10 minutes, something like that.
And he gave you the phone?
Yeah, at some point in the conversation, he gave me the phone, told me to speak to the chick.
And what did you say to her?
I said a couple of words. Hey, who are you? How old are you? Where you live at?
So, at the time of Jay's second interview, we know from the police records that the police knew exactly two things about the 3:32 call. The first is that the call was to someone named Nisha, and the second was that the call was to a line in Silver Spring, which, conveniently, matches the only facts that Jay knows about that call, which is that it was to a girl he'd talked to once on the phone, and that she lived in Silver Spring.
And so then, at trial, Jay tells a very similar story. Adnan was supposed to call him at 3:30 p.m., he hadn't called by 3:45 p.m., so Jay leaves to go see if Jeff G is home. Jeff G wasn't home, but soon thereafter, Jay gets the Best Buy call from Adnan. Again, there's the trunk pop. They go to the park and ride. They're driving to the golf course. Jay makes the call to Patrick slash Patrice, and then we have the Nisha call. And so here is Jay describing it at a trial. Question, do you remember the defendant making any phone calls? Answer, yes. Question, what if any phone call did he make? Answer, to a young lady, I believe somewhere in Silver Spring. Question, and what did you hear him say? Answer, small chat. He actually asked me, did I want to talk to her? I may have said hello, but nothing more. Question, did you get on the phone? Answer, yes, that's what I say. For a brief instance, hello, my name is Jay, and gave him the phone back. I didn't really feel like talking. Question, do you remember where you were at the time? Answer, Forest Park Avenue. Question, and where were you going at that time? Answer, to buy marijuana. Patrick was not home. Let's now turn to Nisha's side of it. So Nisha testified at both the first and second trials. At the first trial, she says, when she's asked about the one time she talked to Jay, it's a little hard to recall, but I remember Adnan telling me that Jay invited him over to a video store that he worked at. And he basically, well, Adnan walked in with his cell phone, and then like he told me to speak with Jay, and I was like, okay, because Jay wanted to say hi. So I said hi to Jay, and that's all I can really recall. When asked about the time of day that this call occurred, Nisha says, I would think towards the evening, but I can't be exactly sure. She also says she thinks the call was in January. At the second trial, and this you might recall from Serial, Nisha again starts to say the call took place after, quote, Jay invited Adnan to come to an adult video store that he worked at, but Yurik cuts her off and asks her about the content of the call. And she says Jay was simply asking how she was doing. According to Nisha, she has no independent recollection of when the call occurred. It could have occurred any time between when Adnan got the cell phone and he was arrested. She says the call wasn't long. It was like a minute or so, but it's unclear whether she's talking about just the Jay portion of the call or the entirety of the phone call. Okay, so that's the groundwork for the so-called Nisha call. And looking at all that background, it leads us to several points that we want to make about this so-called Nisha call. The first point is, we know that Jay has been consistent about very few things about this case, but one thing he's been absolutely consistent about is that he was called by Adnan, the Best Buy call, or wherever the call was for the trunk pop, after 3:40 p.m. And so, Susan, what does that mean about the Nisha call?
It means the Nisha call was not by Adnan, if you think that Jay is telling the truth.
Right, because the Nisha call, again, is at 3:32 p.m. And so across every accounting by Jay of the call, every accounting by Jen, Jay is alone with the cell phone. Adnan is not present. And so if we believe any of their timelines, there's no way that Adnan made the Nisha call because he was still at school and hadn't met up with Jay at this point. And this isn't something where, I mean, a lot of people say, well, maybe Jay's just bad with time. Maybe he wasn't sure. Jay is absolutely clear. Adnan was supposed to call him at 3:30 p.m. When it hit 3:30, he still hadn't called. And so that's an important signpost. It means if we have any credibility to Jay, this Nisha call could not have been made by Adnan. The second point, and this ties back to the first Twitter question and the timeline, is that in every accounting of the Nisha call, Jay places that call after the call to Patrick/Patrice. Well, recall again, the call from the call log that's placed to Patrick/Patrice is at 3:59 p.m. And so doesn't make any sense. If in fact the Nisha call is a legitimate call, that's made at 3:32, the Patrick calls at 3:59. And so this entire narrative in the order of events makes no sense given the arrangement of these two calls in the call log.
And then there's the fact that Jay didn't actually start his job at the adult video store until January 31st. So there's no way that this call could have happened on January 13th when we know both from Jay and Nisha that they only spoke once, and it was when Jay was apparently at work at that store.
And Susan, correct me if I'm wrong, Gutierrez never points this out at trial?
Nope. She never manages to put those two facts together. Although she does elicit on cross that Nisha remembered Adnan walking into Jay's porn store at the time of the phone call, she never also brings out the fact that Jay had not started working at that porn store until January 31st, 1999.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a fundamental part of the state's case. I mean, you know, it's when Sarah talked about it on Serial, she said huge point of emphasis for the prosecution, and it was that this call among Jay, Adnan, and Nisha proves that Adnan's story is a lie, but the key counter to that that would have destroyed this narrative is Jay hadn't started his job at the adult video store. They had the records. We know that they talked to Sis, his employer there at the adult video store. And yet, as far as we can tell, Gutierrez never points out this inconsistency, which would have completely undermined the entire foundation for this Nisha call.
I mean, it was important enough that even for Sarah during Serial, I mean, she says this is, if there is a smoking gun that points at Adnan, this would be it. This call puts them together at that time. But even though Gutierrez may not have been so cognizant of this at trial, Yurik actually was. And Yurik was very careful when he examined Nisha to make sure that he stopped her from testifying about the fact that she was in the second trial, that the phone call happened when he was actually at the store. And that's maybe why, that's why Gutierrez couldn't cross then on that issue, right?
She very easily could have asked the same question about Nisha, about what prompted the call. She could have used the first trial testimony to refresh her recollection, but dropped issue. It's a lost opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, Nisha recalls Adnan walking into Jay's porn store and then temporarily handing the phone off to Jay. That just doesn't have any resemblance to the story that the prosecution's going with, which is that the two of them are in a car, and as they're driving along, Adnan hands the phone off to Jay. What the Nisha call, as the prosecution tells it, also does not resemble is every other call that Adnan made to Nisha. Now, Nisha says that she never called him due to long-distance charges, so all the calls between them were him calling her. But we know from both the phone logs from Adnan's home phone line and his cell phone that his calls to Nisha were never made in the middle of the afternoon on a school day. And just to back up for a moment, what those call records from Anand's home phone line also show is that Nisha is probably the reason he got the cell phone in the first place. Because after they met on January or on New Year's Eve, and between then and January 13th, Anand's home phone line racked up like $50 to $100 in long distance charges based on calls to Nisha alone. So obviously, Anand's parents were going to see that and not be pleased about the fact that either he was calling a girl this much or that he was racking up such a huge bill on long distance charges. But taking both the home phone line calls and the cell line calls, other than the 3:32 p.m. call on January 13th, all of the other calls were either made in the evenings or on days that were not school days. And this fits with what Nisha recalls, because she testified that the call with Jay was towards the evening, which matches Anand's usual pattern of calling her. So to break that down, Anand made 15 calls to Nisha from his cell phone. 12 of those 15 calls were on weekends or after 9 p.m., with most of those being immediately after 9 p.m., because Anand's cell phone had a free weekends and evenings after 9 policy. And the only three that don't meet this pattern are a 7:33 p.m. call on January 12th, the very first call that Anand made after turning his phone on, a 1:44 p.m. call on January 14th, which was a day when both Nisha and Anand were out of school due to the storm, and an 18-second call on February 8th at 8:53 p.m., which means that other than the Nisha call, the one on January 13th, Anand's cell phone is never used to make a call to Nisha before 7:30 p.m. on a school day.
Yeah, what's interesting for me is the quote-unquote Nisha call at 3:32 p.m. is not the only call that Adnan makes on January 13th. In fact, he makes a call at 9:01 p.m., which is consistent with free on weekends and after 9 o'clock. And so, now, why would he make this one outlier, this aberrant call at 3:32 p.m. when he never calls otherwise in a school day during the day? And then he has this other call, which is consistent with his pattern, at 9:01 p.m., right after he has his free minutes kicking in, talking to her. You know, it's strange to have this one island out here, this 3:32 call that makes no sense amidst every single other call that he makes to her on the cell phone.
And we also know that Nisha was on a non-speed dial. And if you had the kind of model phone that Anand had, a Nokia 6160, in order to call someone on speed dial, all you had to do was hold down the number on the keypad that the number was assigned to for a little over 1 second. And then the phone would automatically start dialing.
So it seems like, according to the pattern of Adnan's phone calls and Nisha's recollections about the phone call, even Jay's recollection about the phone call, the length of the call and certain things, that might have just been a bud dial. But guess what? There actually was a real Nisha call, right?
Right. So on Sunday, February 14th, there's a call that lasts 10 minutes and 14 seconds that's made to Nisha from Adnan's cell phone at 7:17 p.m. Last episode, we sort of discredited the reliability of cell tower pings, but for what it's worth, the tower that's pinged and it's an outgoing call is L608C, which is the closest tower to the adult video store where Jay had his job. We also know from Jay's work records that Jay was, in fact, working a shift at the adult video store at this date and this time. In fact, it's the only day that Jay worked during the day at the video store as opposed to the night shift. And so if you break it down and you look at the timing, it matches Jay's initial description of the length of the call when he said it was between 7 to 8 and 10 minutes. And it would seem consistent with the fact that he's working at the video store, which is the explanation that Nisha gives for why the call is being placed. There's really only a couple of things that possibly contradict it. Nisha at the first trial initially thinks the call was in January. Obviously, this is in February. At the second trial, though, as we said, Nisha says she has no independent recollection of when the call took place, and it could have been any time in January or February after Adnan got the phone. And then second, Nisha thinks that, in fact, the call where she talked to Jay was relatively short, but again, it's unclear whether she's talking about the entire length of the phone call or just the portion where she was talking to Jay. And so overall, if you're looking at what's the call that looks the most consistent with this quote-unquote Nisha call, it seems to be this call on February 14th as opposed to the 332 call on January 13th.
And I'm happy to discount the fact that that call is made on L608. But what it is significant for showing and what the cell records can accurately be used to do is to show that the January 13th Nisha call could not have been made from the adult video store where Jay ended up working. So Best Buy and L608 are about 6 miles apart. And the antenna that call's made on is pointing in the opposite direction from Woodlawn. So while we can't use the cell towers for much, we can use them to say with reasonable confidence that the January 13th call was not made at the video store.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think on Serial and for a lot of people, they think that this quote-unquote Nisha call is one of the biggest pieces of evidence of Adnan's guilt. I sort of now, at this point, look at it a bit differently. And I don't know whether Susan and Rabia, you agree with me, but my analysis is sort of this. I trust Nisha in the sense that I don't know about exactly when the call was placed, but I trust Nisha. This call took place when Jay invited Adnan to the adult video store where he worked. So after January 31st, and while he was there, Jay asked to speak to Nisha on the phone. Now, what do we know about Jay's story? Jay's story is Adnan was threatening him, you know, the whole West Side Hitman thing. He was threatening Stephanie. If that's true first, why in the world would Jay invite Adnan to the adult video store? But then secondly, Jay's story is Adnan killed Hay and then coerced him into helping him with the aftermath and the burial. If you're Jay, why in the world would you ask to speak to the new girl he's pursuing if in fact his previous girlfriend was killed by Adnan and it led to this horrible situation where Jay was forced to take part in the aftermath and burial? I mean, does it make any sense to the two of you that, assuming Nisha's correct, that this entire scenario would have happened if Adnan in fact did kill Hay?
No.
I mean, I'll put on my conspiracy hat here and say that if Jay himself asked Adnan to come to the video store and said, hey, can I speak to your girl? That at that point, maybe he knew it was important that he had spoke, that part of his story was, you know, as he's talking to the police, that he had to have at least one call in which he talked to Nisha. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's one possible theory. If we can establish that Jay was talking to the cops before February 14th, that would certainly lend a lot of credibility to that thinking.
I mean, by the time we get to trial, Jay is swearing up and down that he only saw Adnan twice after the murder. So clearly, Nisha's testimony contradicts him in that respect because, according to her, Adnan and Jay are hanging out all buddy-buddy. Whereas Jay says the only time he sees Adnan is when Adnan does come to the video store, but that's to threaten him. So I don't see Jay, after being told by Adnan, if you tell anyone, I'm going to stick the West Side Hitman on you, to then go, hey, who's that girl you're talking to? Can you pass the phone to me? No. I mean, they went to parties together and talked on the phone, so.
I mean, the only other obvious explanation would be because none of this is happening. Because he's not afraid of Adnan. Because he did not see Adnan bury a body. Because there's nothing that Jay actually said ever happened. And so they have a totally normal relationship still. And so, and that's it. I mean, that's the obvious explanation here.
Which could be the other reason you're cut off Nisha. It's not just because her story contradicts the Nisha call. It contradicts Jay's story about the aftermath of the murder.
And if we tie this back to our answer to the first Twitter question, this is absolutely not collateral. And it seems that Yurik knew the call that Nisha was describing could not have been this call on January 13th because it's clear he knew Jay was not working at the video store at that point in time. And so, I don't know, for him to shift that answer that Nisha's giving and try to basically downplay it and sweep it under the rug, it's kind of troubling. I mean, that's the way that this was played out at trial. It's very troubling for me in terms of how this was sold to the jury. This goes back to the topic we discussed in the first part of the episode.
Our last Twitter question today comes from Alex Nicole Becknell, whose Twitter handle is @AlexNicole9. She writes, are cell phone records different now because of technology? Yes, they are different. And they can be more reliable now, but as most lawyer answers are. It depends. For instance, we now have much smaller cells are more commonly used. We have picocells, which would cover a single building. And we have Wi-Fi tracking. So there are scenarios in which cell phone location data is, to a degree, reliable, assuming you can determine where those cell sites are and what their range actually is. Back in 99, in contrast, the cell sites were designed to cover large amounts of territory and to maximize coverage, which is not necessarily the case today. However, in his recent Intercept interview, Urich claimed that the cell phone records were in fact more accurate in 1999 than they are today. He objected to Sarah Koenig's description of the cell phone records in Serial because, and I quote, "She starts off noting that there are recent attacks on the use of cell phone evidence, but does not inform the listener that the technology used today is different from that in use at the time of trial, and most of the attacks today are due to that difference." The two reasons he gives involve, first, that there's an objection in the courts today to having police officers give testimony concerning cell site locations, which is a trend I'm a big fan of because it is ridiculous to have police officers trying to testify to how cell sites work and how cell site location data should be interpreted. And as he points out, that would not apply in this case because an RF engineer did testify. But again, that doesn't address the underlying problems with the cell site data. That just addresses the fact that you don't have a police officer testifying about RF engineering. The second issue that Urich brings up, he says, today's towers have switching technology such that if all the cells on a tower are in use, it can switch the call to a different tower, sometimes one quite a distance away. I mean, it's not that he's wrong, it's that it's irrelevant because nothing about the inaccuracy in the cell site data that we discussed last week has to do with whether or not there's switching going on among the towers. The issue is with how a cell phone connects to the network and what you can actually predict based on cell site data. So, you know, I decided to run this by Mike Cherry as well and to hear his thoughts on Urich's claim that cell site location data is less accurate now than it was 16 years ago.
The prosecutor in this case recently said that cell phone records were more reliable back then than they are now in terms of showing location. Does that match your experience?
I don't know what they based that on. It's just, these are just phrases, empty phrases. They sound great. It's a great soundbite.
Well, I've come to the conclusion that in this case, the police decided early on that Adnan was their man. They conducted their entire investigation in a way that disregarded anyone else as a suspect and focused solely on creating their case against him. I imagine, actually, that no matter the situation, they would have created a narrative that fit their theory. Like, initially they thought Adnan had the cell phone, so they began by trying to create a narrative that fit that. Then they realized, oh crap, Jay had the cell phone, and they had to now work him into the narrative. Not just work him into the narrative in a way that made sense for him to have the phone, but in a way that Adnan deliberately gave him the cell phone to help with the murder. In other words, it became a premeditated first-degree crime. Tougher charges, right? But I'm just as convinced that if Adnan had no cell phone, they would have argued that he followed Hay in his car after school and killed her by himself with no help. And if Adnan didn't have a car, they would have argued that he got in her car, killed her, and, I don't know, ran back to school from Best Buy or something similar. In any event, these things didn't matter to them. They treated all these issues like collateral facts to the spine of the story that Adnan killed Hay, period. Now, we get hundreds of questions about this. Why on earth would the police do that? What did they have to gain by nailing Adnan? Why would Jay implicate himself if none of this were true? Why would the cops and the state prefer getting a conviction to getting the right criminal? And I wish the answer was that this was a very unique case, that they just got it wrong, that they got tunnel vision and just screwed up. Except the sad truth is, all of this is much more common than you think. Next time on Undisclosed. Special thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, to Baluki, who designed our logo, and to Amar Naji, our sound editor. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us online on social media on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @undisclosedpod. Tweet us your questions and comments using the hashtag undisclosed.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.